Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome back to Surf Splendor. This is your host, David Scales. We have an exciting show for you today with big wave surfer, surfing for change activist, Kyle Tierman. But before we get into my conversation with Kyle, I just wanted to update you that we've instituted a donation option on surfsplendorpodcast.com. So I know that you have heard Scott and I discuss that we would be introducing that. Well, it is official. It has been introduced. So if you go on to surfsplendorpodcast.com, there is a link in the menu for to click donate. And then it's just a real simple PayPal donation if you would like to support this show. This show and all of its archives will remain free to everyone. There are no perks for donating to the show, other than the warm feeling inside that comes with giving so generously. The show will remain free and free for all. But after 140 episodes of Surf Splendor, it is about time that we figure out a way to monetize it. So donations is going to be the first step in that effort. And there's details on that link for how those donations, where that money will go. And so you can read up on it there. And I'll be perfectly honest, I listen to far more podcasts than I have ever donated to. And so I totally understand if you don't donate. But if you do donate, consider that other listeners are not. So donate whatever you feel comfortable with. There's actually an option when you open up the YouTube link to set a recurring monthly donation, which I recommend. That might be the most efficient way to do this. So, I mean, if you did it for a reasonable amount, a small amount, let's say $5 a month, you probably wouldn't even notice that expense, but it would go a long way towards helping this show growing. And that's the thing. I mean, consider that you have 140 episodes in the archives that that donation is going towards, and then it's going towards a weekly show. But more importantly is it'll help this show to grow. I mean, the reality is if we are seeing some rewards from the hard work, we will have the opportunity to expand it in new ways, whether that's through more frequent shows or perhaps travel shows, perhaps live shows, perhaps events. I know I did a film screening maybe about 2 years ago for Bella Vita, where we rented out a theater in Long Beach and hosted a screening, and that went really, really well. So maybe we'll be able to do more things like that, introduce t-shirts. There's just all sorts of things that it opens up for us. So exciting. It's an exciting time. So anyway, surfsplendorpodcast.com/donate is the link. All right. So without further ado, I'm going to pitch to my conversation with Kyle Tierman. And we uncover, I mean, a lot of really interesting stuff. The kid is super, super interesting. I refer to him as a kid because he's 26. And to me now, that is young. That's a weird thing to say. From the ages of 18 to 25, Kyle created and hosted this YouTube series called Surfing for Change. And he really was kind of the first surfer that I know of in the professional surf space who really took advantage of YouTube as a platform. He's kind of built his career on being a YouTuber, but he's done really amazing work through that Surfing for Change series. And he's transitioned out of that and kind of has new opportunities and endeavors with Patagonia, Discovery Digital Network. It's an expansion of what he did surfing for change. So exciting times for Kyle. He's an interesting figure that I've paid attention to over the last, 8 years or so. And I would argue that even if you don't recognize his name, you probably saw his TED talk that he did. We get into that in this show a little bit, but the biggest memory jog that I could provide for you is he's the only guy to have ever delivered a TED talk wearing a wetsuit. So that's Kyle. All right. So without further ado, enjoy my conversation with Kyle Tierman. This is David Scales for Surf Splendor. I'll be back at the end of the episode to sign us off. Thanks. Why are you sitting on your broken heart tonight? You wanna sing like us, you gotta rip your eyes out. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No one has ever loved you more than this. Why don't you come and feel it out? I can promise. Shamelessly gonna document with a selfie stick along the way.
What?
I'm shamelessly going to document this with a selfie stick along the way.
Oh, no. No worries, man. Let's get it out through the other channels. If there's no shame. Like, if there's one person you don't need to be embarrassed about using a selfie stick in front of, it's fucking me, all right?
I do have no shame about it. I'm super into it. I just got into it like a month ago, though. I'm like a few years behind the selfie stick trend.
Yeah.
Which only lasted for a short period.
So is there anything that you don't want to talk about or things that you swear on the podcast?
Anything's fine.
Okay.
Anything goes, and then, of course, I can edit as well.
Okay.
So a couple quick icebreaker first questions before we get into origin story stuff. How long can you hold your breath? First question.
So about a year ago, I took a performance freediving course. It's a 3-day course that happens down in Newport. I took it with my friend Ricky Whitlock, and it was trained with this guy. Our trainer was the guy who trained David Blaine to his 17-minute and 4-second breath hold.
Wow!
And the way the course works is you do one day of in-class workshops where you learn all about apnea, you learn all about what actually happens to the human body when you're underwater and you're experiencing hypoxia, which is lack of the buildup of CO2 in your bloodstream. And it's fascinating what happens to the human body when you're underwater because I mean, basically what you get from the course is you can hold your breath a lot longer than you think you can. Okay. When you get that initial, I need to breathe, you're usually about halfway there.
Okay.
Because your body's really good at what's called blood shunting. So it first, you know, your fingers get kind of tingly because the blood is, your body is pushing all the blood to your brain and to your heart, your vital organs, right? So your body's kind of built to be underwater for a lot longer than you think you can. Okay. So then the second day, you get in the pool, and there are a few different types of courses. One is for free diving and spearfishing, and that's where you're holding your breath under kind of optimal conditions, right? When you're going to descend, you have time to breathe up. But this course was specifically for big wave surfing, so they would put us in positions where we would have to do a bunch of push-ups, and then we would get thrown into a pool with a bunch of weights and see how long we could hold our breath with our friend kind of beating us up underwater, which, I mean, cut your time down by a quarter, right, if you have a high heart rate. But usually when you have a big wave that's going to land on your head, you're not, you haven't been able to breathe up for 2 minutes. So that was the course that I did. And we did all these different techniques where you had a high heart rate, you did, and then but we did also what's called a static apnea breath hold, which is where you breathe up for as long as it takes. Usually what you're doing is you're taking very slow, deliberate exhales, because when you breathe, when you exhale slowly, your heart rate slows down. Mm-hmm. That's why if you're ever getting ready for a big speech or a big thing, you want to take these slow, deep exhales. It helps slow your heart rate down. And then you take a few deep breaths out of the top of your chest. And then your final one, basically kind of like filling up a gas tank. You fill it up from your breath, your belly to your lungs, and then all the way even. You lift your shoulders and go, and then you just relax. So we did those on the second day, where it was like, all right, we've stretched beforehand. This is as far as you can go. And the longest that I was able to get to was 4 minutes and 7 seconds. And it was a really fun experience to be in safe conditions while holding your breath.
Yeah.
I mean, most times, right, like, you just don't want to push it that hard, because if you pass out, you pass out. And if there's no one around, you're going to die.
Yep. Yeah, you hear horror stories.
Yeah, and I actually on so at the end of the second day, we did a few rounds. And I was like, you know what, I'm just going to fucking go for it. Like, if there's ever a time to hold my breath for as long as I can, it's now. And my buddy Ricky Whitlock was right there with me, and you're basically face down in a pool, and every 20 seconds he taps you on your shoulder, and you have to lift up a finger and then put the finger down to show that you're still conscious. And I was like, I'm just going to push it and go as far as I can. And I remember going through this kind of meditation technique where you relax your face, relax your shoulders, relax your biceps, your elbows, just every part of your body you tell to slow down and relax. And another technique that they use is to, you really picture a place that you know in a familiar way, and it's like a calm place, whether it's like a childhood beach that you grew up on or like a childhood home, and you kind of just walk yourself through that situation, and it helps you take your mind off of the fact that you can't breathe.
Yeah.
Because it is really uncomfortable, right? And you're getting all these like and I was just like, I'm going through it, and I hear him get to 4 minutes on the second round, and but it was kind of distant at that point. Like, I was doing a really good job, like, going through my childhood home. And all of a sudden, Ricky has pulled me up, and he's pulled my mask off my face, and he's slapping me. And I'm doing the what they call the samba, which is where I'm going, like, you're not really inhaling and exhaling. And I looked at him, and I was like, why did you pull me up? I could have gone longer. And him and everyone else in the course is like, dude, you just passed out.
Wow.
You didn't respond to that last one. And it was one where I didn't fully black out. I kind of browned out, where I just wasn't responsive.
But your head was still in that meditative space.
My head was still in that space, which was kind of fascinating to me, where, like, I didn't have that. I didn't know, like, this, oh, my God, I'm going to pass out. Okay, right. I'm passed out.
Yeah.
Like, I felt like I was still doing it.
Hmm.
Your mind does these really interesting things, right, when you're holding your breath. And a lot of times what it does, it takes you into this kind of euphoric and peaceful state. So we got to hear some wild stories from people that are a lot better at holding the breath than I am. So, I mean, when I say, you know, I can hold my breath for 4 minutes, if you ask me to hold my breath right now, there's no way I could hold my breath for 4 minutes. I was in a course under optimal conditions, and it was one thing that was really amazing is how fast it went. Like, that skill got away from me when I wasn't practicing.
Right.
Because then I didn't practice for a couple months. And you know, when you're surfing, you're not really holding your breath. You're like, you're duck diving, right? Yeah. Like, maybe for 5 seconds you're underwater. And even, you know, when you're surfing to the end of a wave, right, and you like fall in the end section and you are under for 5 seconds and you're like, oh my God, I almost died, right? Like,
yeah.
It was amazing how quickly that skill kind of got away from me. Whereas now there are some techniques that I'll try and use to get back into those places. But man, if you don't use it, you lose it. That's for sure.
It's interesting talking about your head goes into a really weird space when you're holding your breath. I mean, I wonder how much of that is the actual holding of your breath or the meditation. Or then I also wonder how much overlap there is between the techniques required to hold your breath and the techniques required to practice meditation. Like there's actually, they're pretty similar, you know?
100%.
So, yeah.
I mean, the fact that you can think about something right now and your heart rate will... I mean, if you think about it, a hot chick that you have a crush on, your heart rate will start to speed up, right? If you start to think about some peaceful willow that you grew up near, your heart rate will slow down. Like, our thoughts have an immense power over our bodies, that's for sure.
It makes me realize that, like, I mean, you went to the breath holding seminar for big wave surfing specifically, right? But. Yeah. Realistically, it has a lot more application for your life just in terms of general well-being and general health and would benefit a lot of things, even if you're not going to go surf big waves.
There's something about physical tests that I think we really lack in our culture. Like for me as a young man, like it was actually one of those experiences that man, like, it was kind of profound for me, just doing this 3-day course and, like, really pushing myself to a point of, like, I want to go as far as I can. Man, like, we really lack that in our culture, and I think that that's why people are so attracted to figures like Shane Dorian and Mark Healy, who are hunters, and they're out there doing this man shit. It's, like, because we don't have that anymore, and there's something so real and, like, tactile and just grounded about some of those experiences that you have, where you have to put yourself in those situations and see how far you can go, because we live in this world of social media and what do people think of us and, you know, anxiety. And so it's almost like this constant Wi-Fi of anxiety that everyone is just riddled with.
Yeah.
And there's something that I notice. I mean, I'm drawn to those types of people where I'm like, fuck, you just have like a kind of grounded centerness where those people are really good at shaking your hand and looking you in the eye most times.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
It does. Well, I think, you know, dogs, you domesticate a dog and then you have to give it a Kong with peanut butter inside so they can dig for the peanut butter because it represents a former life of theirs where they had to hunt for their food. It's the same thing with humans, where we come from hunter-gatherers. And now our life is just so dang convenient. We don't need to hunt anymore, and we have this impulse to do things like that and to test ourselves. So we're drawn to that when other people do it, you know?
Yeah, and ultimately, right, it's not even about reaching the goal. Like, we want to reach the goal, but I mean, it's so cliche to say, but it's real when you're actually doing it. Like, it is about this process and being able to be comfortable with that conversation in your head.
Yeah, you feel a lot more alive doing that than you do sitting on the sofa, you know?
That's for sure.
Let's get into your origin story real quick. Where'd you grow up? How'd you get involved in surfing?
Grew up right here in Santa Cruz, California. You know, youngest of five. All my older brothers and sisters surf. You know, Santa Cruz town. We had a half pipe in our backyard. So I was skating from the age of six and started surfing when I was 10.
Were you competing and all that?
Yeah, I started doing the NSSAs with my friend Nat Young, who...
I've heard of him.
You've heard of him. We've all heard of him. I mean, so Nat's mom, Rosie, is this super mom who, from the age of 11, would drive us down on the weekends to go compete in the Gold Coast NSSA contest down at, like, C Street and... Port Hueneme and all these little beach breaks. And I remember from like 11 years old, we went down there in our first contest And we were always super intimidated to surf with the down south kids because they were like, we grew up surfing right hand point breaks, and basically Nat did too, but he would always kind of take these different routes. He's like, oh no, let's go surf the left. Like, let's go surf these weird little beach breaks. And we'd always be like, no, I just want to go surf the lane every day and like surf this right hand point break. Hence, Santa Cruz surfers get really good at surfing right hand point breaks, but you put them on a left hand beach break and they usually suck. But Nat took that extra little initiative to be like, I want to get good at surfing these other types of waves. And I remember we went down and we surfed a contest at Newport Beach. Mm-hmm. And by that time, Andrew Doheny was already – Andrew was like – Andrew Doheny and Kolohe Andino were already these superstar Groms. And no one had ever really heard of Nat because Nat kind of got into surfing a little bit later than most of those kids. Like, he started surfing when I think he was like 10, which is like late compared to a lot of those kids. And we went down and I think I lost like second heat. And Nat just started destroying kids. And he ended up getting second to Andrew Doheny in the contest. And it was this moment when, like, all the Santa Cruz kids, because we would go down, like, Rosie would drive all of us down. And we were all like, whoa, like, I didn't know you could do that. Like, dude, you beat all the little down south kids. And it was like, from that moment on, he was doing a contest every single weekend. And I went down, I would do the NSSA Gold Coast contest with them. And but he was doing like Gold Coast, he was doing Southwest. It was literally every single weekend his mom would drive him down to Central California or Southern California to surf these other kinds of waves, which now obviously it's paid off for him because kind of most Santa Cruz surfers, again, like, they're really good at surfing one type of wave.
Right.
But that was kind of a cool experience to see, to grow up with him and kind of see all of his success. So, yeah, I did NSSAs, until I was, like, 17. Never really did too well in them. You know, I made some finals and that kind of thing. But I think it actually wasn't it's weird surfing growing up. Like, when you're a Grom, you kind of surf because your friends surf.
Yeah.
Like, it's this social thing where it's like, you
live in,
like,
this environment.
You live in this environment. Like, you know, go to Mission Hill Junior High, Santa Cruz High School. It's like, you hang out with surfers. You go surfing.
Yeah.
And it's almost weird when I describe it. Like, I almost feel like surfing wasn't something that was inside of me. Like, I did it for the love of it on my own terms. Until I started going on some surf trips with my good friend Kyle Boothman, who's a really good surfer from Santa Cruz, a filmmaker. And we started going down to some of the beach breaks down in Mexico. And it was this like experience where I was like, holy shit, I didn't know that waves hit you this hard. Mm. And I didn't know that you could, like, I remember so vividly, like, on one of my first trips down there being like 15 or something like that, and surfing one of these beach breaks and just getting inside a barrel that I had never experienced before. Like, I was just getting these closeout barrels, but being like, holy shit, like, this is a whole nother, it's almost like a whole nother sport.
Yeah.
And from a skating background, like, I was always super into that, like, kind of just push it, like, going around. We would skate pools in the backyards of people's houses, and like, skating has that very much like just go for it kind of attitude. And I felt like I really found that when I started traveling a little bit more, and from there on out I was just like, oh, this is my jam. Like, I want to go around and get barreled.
Yeah. Well, I can relate to that. You know, I've grown up surfing, and I can relate to wanting to get barreled and getting bigger barrels and wider barrels. What I can't relate to is your interest in big wave surfing. And I mean, for listeners, there is a definable difference between surfing big barrels like that versus surfing Mavericks and proper big wave surfing. What is your interest in big wave surfing? Like, again, I have zero interest in that. It's just it's almost a different sport, you know?
Yeah.
So what was your, was it a transition from that into big wave surfing, or what did that look like for you? And why is, it seems like you're almost more defined now as a big wave surfer in terms of your professional surfing career, you know?
I guess. I mean, I think that part of it's just because Mavericks is right up the road from us, so we're always out there. And there's always a ton of media at Mavericks, so that's where the photos get published. I would say that I still, more than anything, like, my highest highs come from a 10 to 12 foot, you know, barreling day at Puerto Escondido. I think that nothing beats that.
Okay, cool.
But then again, I mean, just taking off on a big wave at Mavericks is pretty darn cool, especially if it's a good, clean day. Like, who knew it could be so fun just going straight?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering if maybe it's because I grew up in Southern California and we don't have that wave near us that I was. Is it just that if you grow up in this area, like, everybody goes there when the waves get big and you're kind of. It's a cultural, social thing, or?
I mean, I definitely think that there's, you are a product of your influences and your surroundings. And I mean, Anthony Tashnik lives on my street. All these guys are going up. Tyler Fox is my housemate. So I think that a big part of it, like, I guess that transition was the fact that Tyler is my housemate and he had some big boards for me. And it was kind of just like, well, cool, let's go try it out. And I definitely feel more comfortable at Mavericks than maybe I should.
Okay.
Like, I think that there's something where I never really thought that I was going to surf big waves growing up when I was, you know, 12 years old going down to NSSAs with Nat. But it's almost like this feeling of, like, like, oh, I can do this. Like, this is something that I can do. And maybe it comes from that background of, like, awling off of 10 stairs when I was a kid skating and just that kind of, like, attitude that it takes to, like, take a slam and get back up and do it again. And again, it's a whole other sport in terms of, like, figuring it out. Like, there's this element of just, like, so much more than the act of surfing the wave that I think is really cool. I've always been really fascinated with, you know, how swells work and where they hit the reef and where you want to be when you hit the reef. And you look at a lot of the best big wave surfers, like, some of them are most of them are really talented, but they also have this other skill set of being able to read waves and read swells and be there on the right days. That I'm fascinated by. So, but then again, like, I really do think that, like, surfing a 10-foot barrel is amazing, and it also takes a lot more skill to surf a 10-foot Porto barrel than it does to drop in on a wave at Mavericks.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a lot of kooks out at Mavericks, people who are just kind of like, oh, cool, I'm going to sit on the shoulder and go in and, you know, take a photo, which is really dangerous, because I think that what Mavericks is like, it's all good until it's not.
Yeah.
Right? Like, totally. I'm not saying that it doesn't take skill to surf big waves, but you can, if you're in the right spot, like, and you're a decent surfer, you can, and the wave's allowing it, you can drop in on that wave and make it a lot of times. There's definitely a difference between the way Greg Long surfs a big wave to your average Joe. But I think that if you put average Joe in a 12 foot Puerto barrel, there's no way they're going to make that.
He's not going to luck into it.
They're not going to luck into it and navigate it. Like,
and he's not going to luck into an air reverse at lowers either.
Totally.
You know, like,
totally. Which is why I think that there are aspects of big wave surfing that it's kind of like, it just makes it a little bit like, ooh, like, gosh, that guy's doing it like too. And, but again, it's like, whatever, you know, who am I? I don't want to get all high and mighty. Like,
No, but I'm glad you said it, because I have no experience out there, but I do wonder that at times, because I see those guys who will remain nameless here surfing big waves and then see them try to surf like a normal day at the local spot, and I'm like, that guy's a kook, dude. Like,
yeah.
What is he doing? If he can surf out at Mavericks, I could surf Mavericks, you know? Like,
right.
But obviously, like I said, I have no interest, and I never want to shame anybody who's out there, because it's like, I'm not out there.
Right.
You know?
And at the same time, like, I mean, you look at the photos of a really crowded day out there and you're like, oh my God, I have no interest. But like, if you want to get one, like if you really are like, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to sit deep and I'm going to get one, like you can do it.
Yeah.
You just need to have that intent
right.
while going out there. And I think that a lot of people go out with the intent of, I'm just going to check it out and sit on the shoulder and see how it goes. And then you end up burning someone who's taken off deep. And yeah. I think that's kind of lame.
Totally. I want to transition a little bit into kind of what you're best known for. And I'll preface it with saying that, like, prior to this digital media age, there's really two ways to make a living as a professional surfer. There's competitive surfer and there's, you know, free surfer, but both of which were kind of reliant on the mainstream media and their compliance to promote that surfer's image. In this modern era, we've seen a lot of people take control of their image by creating their own content, distributing it themselves, and building their own audiences with unfettered access to them, you know, because of it. You've really embraced YouTube, and that's been your platform to communicate with your audience. Tell me about how that came to be and what are the pros and cons of that model?
I hate when people talk about the image of, like, it's so true, like, right, like, that everyone has their image and, like, how are you defined? But, like, I mean, I'll tell you how it all came about.
Yeah,
right? It all came about that I was going on some surf trips when I was younger, and I've always been naturally curious about the world. My mom ensured that. She's a documentary filmmaker. And
is she?
Yeah, she basically said, look, Kyle, like, if you're going to go down to Chile, you better learn something about this country.
Hmm.
Not only because you're going there and it's important to learn, but as an American, America put Pinochet in power. I mean, people might not know this, but I mean, it was the Chicago Boys, which was basically an experiment of the United States to put Pinochet, who was one of the most infamous dictators ever, into power in Chile. You know, and then he ruled for a number of years with an iron fist. I mean, the amount of people who disappeared in Chile under his rule is astounding.
Really?
And there are still the scars of that on the country. I mean, if you're a musician back then playing a song that Pinochet didn't like,
right,
you know, he'd cut your hands off. And it's a very brutal history, and a lot. And that doesn't mean that we need to go around with this, like, American guilt, but I think that it's important as surfers to understand the places that we travel to, and that we do have an effect on them. There is a history that many times our country is associated and directly involved with, and they're fascinating stories. So she gave me a few books on some early trips, and from there, man, it seriously just came from me asking one question to the next. I mean, we as surfers find ourselves in these places that they're really, like, not too many other people go to those parts of the world.
Right.
Right? And there are fascinating stories that won't get told unless we tell them. So, again, like, I had basic background in filmmaking skills. I mean, like, my whole family does filmmaking.
Okay.
My mom's a documentary filmmaker. My dad's a filmmaker. My brother is a filmmaker. My uncle's a filmmaker. Like,
I had no idea.
It's just, yeah, everyone.
Okay.
So I had basic skills in knowing, like, oh, if you know, press the red button and put it up to someone's face, because if you want to get good audio, put it real close. The first story that I did that probably still now kind of defines me was,
sure,
was going down to Chile with my friend Ryan Craig, who Chachi, he's a staff photographer at Surfer now. And I went down to Chile and did this story on a proposed coal power plant that was going in on the beach in central southern Chile. Did some learning about how these projects of corporations happen, and that a lot of times it's these financial institutions that are responsible for green lighting the projects. Same way, if you need to get a loan for a house or a business, you need a loan from a bank. Big corporations need loans too. So we did this little story about how this proposed coal plant from a company called AES Jenner was being financed by Bank of America, that when you put your money into a bank, it doesn't stay there. Banks use your money to lend out. And it was kind of this story of following your money upstream, mm-hmm. and that you could be a surfer in Santa Cruz like I was. I had my money in B of A, and that it could be going to financing a coal power plant down in Chile. And I talk about how when if you have your money in a local bank or credit union, that money is lent out within your community typically and can be used to strengthen your community instead of having it be sucked out and used around the world. So that was in 2008, right when the financial collapse happened. It was the first time the American public was paying any attention to money and where it was going, because all of their money was gone that year.
Yeah.
Similar at the same time, Arianna Huffington from Huffington Post was doing this campaign called Move Your Money, encouraging people to get their money out of local banks. So it was this perfect storm of like me being this 18-year-old surfer kid who told this story. You know, Chachi did a good job taking photos along the way, so we had had access to other media, and we released it, and like a lot of people saw the movie, a lot of people started moving their money, and man, I just ate that up. Like I felt like it was such a just so much more important to be doing that. Not to say that you can't also surf. I couldn't surf along the way, but
did some sick backside blowtails in that video.
Right. Well, I mean, it's surfing, right? And if you really want to dedicate your life to surfing, there's really only so much you can talk about.
Yeah,
I agree. It can become pretty one-dimensional if you don't maintain curiosity and continue to ask those questions. So from there, I started this YouTube series called Surfing for Change, where I would travel, usually on a shoestring budget, you know, would pull some money together from my sponsors, Patagonia and Sector 9, who are both mission-based companies. And they're like, sure, we'll like get you a plane ticket, to go here. And, you know, I'd roll into J-Bay with my selfie cam and be like, hi, I'm Kyle. There's a proposed nuclear power plant at J-Bay. Let's talk about nuclear power for 6 minutes. Or, you know, I went to Indonesia with my brother, who I said was a filmmaker, and we did a story called Indonesia Trash Tubes, which is about Bali's trash epidemic.
And we've all seen those images of guys getting shacked in, like, you know, green, beautiful water, except for the fact that there's candy wrappers getting sucked up in the barrel with the guy.
Yeah, that Zach Noyle photo is amazing.
Yeah.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
And then, so I did that for a number of years, covered everything from the GMO protests in Hawaii to the importance of open watersheds in Baja, to really everything that I was curious about. Like, I have this strong belief that you can learn everything through anything.
Hmm.
And what I mean by that is that I knew that I was interested in surfing. I knew that I was interested in traveling. I mean, I would go on these trips and have my mind blown.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that if I just asked a few questions, it would get me to some interesting places.
Yeah.
So people always ask me, like, well, how did you come up with this or that? I was like, what? I mean, I had the opportunity to get these little micro degrees in all these subjects. Yeah. Like, I can tell you about plastic pollution now. I can tell you about the state of GMOs in Hawaii. Like, and that's just fun for me, man. Mm-hmm. Like, the second we stop learning, we start dying. And I would guess that a lot of your listeners are those types of learners, right? Like, typically people who listen to podcasts are these voracious learners. And like, for me, I'm that same way, man. Like, I get so much value out of podcasts. A lot of the stories that I've done have just been from conversations with people, listening to podcasts. So I did the Surfing for Change series for a number of years, and then same but different, kind of transitioned this past year to working as a correspondent for Discovery Digital Networks. So that's their online arm, doing a lot of ocean stories. So this year I've had the opportunity to go down. We got one that's coming out that I hope people really dig. It's called Hunting Wild Pig to Save Coral Reef.
Hmm.
So we went to Hawaii on the Big Island, which is where this past El Nino winter, one of the largest coral bleaching events, the largest coral bleaching event in recorded history happened. So coral, 1 in 4 marine organisms live in association with coral. It's the Amazon rainforest of the ocean. And it's really important that we keep it alive because it's where all of the fish live and breed. So coral is also this kind of drama queen in a sense, because it needs very specific conditions to thrive. It needs specific water temperatures. It needs clear water so that it has access to sunlight so that it can photosynthesize. What gives coral its color is this single-celled organism called zooxanthellae. So zooxanthellae is what basically allows it to grow. It's what gives it its color. And when coral is hit with poor living conditions, for example, the water gets too hot for too long, for whatever reason, the zooxanthellae will leave the coral. And that's what you see. That's what people refer to when they talk about coral bleaching. So that's the white coral that is, it starts to slowly break down. As waves come in and swells hit the coral, it starts to break, and ultimately the fish habitat is destroyed after a number of years. It's a slow process, which is why it's hard to tell the story, because you don't necessarily get those visuals. Like, like fish will still live in bleached coral for a certain amount of time. Bleached coral can also has this grace period to be able to come back.
Okay.
But this last winter in Hawaii, a lot of coral got bleached. And on the Big Island specifically, one of the main factors of coral being able to come back is its ability to be in clear water, because coral needs clear water for sunlight to photosynthesize the coral. And one of the main reasons that a lot of the coral is not coming back is because these hoofed animals, wild pig and goat specifically, will destroy these watersheds. They'll dig up vegetation and they'll root around for shrubs and grubs. And what happens then is that in these watersheds, when Hawaii gets these heavy rains, is that there's no soil retention. It's all this kind of like loose, churned up soil. And if you've ever been to Hawaii, you've seen it. These huge mud plumes go out into the ocean and it basically blankets the coral and suffocates it. So right now there's a huge initiative to fence off these sensitive areas so that native vegetation can return. So we got to go out, and we went out on a boat with NOAA, Division of Aquatic Resources, and we sampled coral from various areas, and we saw like there's some of the coral has come back. It's this, you know, vibrant, colorful coral, and then in other areas where there's, you know, just up from watersheds, there's sediment that covers it, and it hasn't come back, and it's this graveyard of coral. Now, then we got to go on a pig hunt, which I've never gone on before, but Mark Healy actually told me, he's like, you need to meet up with this guy, Justin Lee. Justin Lee is, check him out on Instagram. He is one of the most badass humans on planet Earth. He's a professional spear fisherman, professional hunter, like constant comedy hour guy. And he took
is
us
he
on
based on the Big Island.
He's a Hawaiian. He's based on the Big Island. And he took us out on a pig hunt. And it was such a wild experience for me, man. Because
what
just
does he hunt with?
A bow. Okay. So we went out on two hunts. We went out in the evening with a bow, and he got one, like, I would say maybe like 30 minutes into the hunt. We're like, we're running around, you're going through this kind of like Vietnam style, like, you know, 6 foot grass, like running through areas that you would never run through. I mean, it's hard. Like, these things aren't just cruising. Like, they're hiding, and you have to go either at dusk or at dawn. So we went at dusk, and we saw one. He scattered it. It was a clean shot. Got it, dressed the pig, and we carried it out. Now, the next morning, they were like, well, we want to see you get one, Kyle. So I was like, these things are, they're big. Like, it's a, the one he got was like a 160-pound animal with these razor-sharp teeth, and the things move fast, like fast. And I'll tell you another kind of funny story, little anecdote, is that so pig are, they breed like bunny rabbits. A female pig, it's called a sow, is sexually mature at 1 year old, and they have three breeding cycles in a year. And they can have 6 to 10 babies every breeding cycle.
Dang.
So you can have, I mean, you have to take out 70% of pig populations every single year for them to just maintain steady numbers.
Got it.
So the pig that Justin shot was a boar, and it was chasing a sow that was in heat. So he gets the pig, and he flips it over, and he's like, so the reason this guy didn't see us is because it was ready to jump this lady. And he's like, and all right, guys, like, you might want to turn the cameras off, but you got to do this before we carry it out. Otherwise, it's going to get all over you.
Oh, no.
And he grabs the pig's cock, and he shoots a load out. And everyone on Discovery seems like, oh, man. And I'm just like, oh, man. And he's like, yeah, man, like, otherwise, Kyle, you would carry this thing out and it would just get all over your pants.
Oh my God.
So
who discovered that initially?
I don't know who discovered that one initially, but something
wild.
That's not typically talked about in the hunting world. I just looked at the camera, I'm like, see, their breeding cycles are astounding.
So you guys got all that?
So we got all that. I don't think that they put that part in the final piece.
Right.
But
that's for the DVD extras.
That's for the DVD extras. Yeah, that's the X-rated version. So then the next morning we went out with dogs, because another form of hunting is you go around with dogs, and the dogs will sniff out the pig, and they'll corral the pig. Basically, you can get a little dog that can corral and kind of confuse a massive boar, and then what you're supposed to do is you pick up the hind legs, you get it, you pick up the hind legs, you flip it over, and you get it in the heart with a knife. So they gave me the knife, and they're like, all right, Kyle, like, you're up. I'm like, oh shit. Like,
were you up for it?
I was up for it. Okay. I mean, I was up for it, but yeah, I was up
had
for
you
it.
Ever killed an animal before?
I'm fish. Yeah. Go spear fishing.
Yeah, a little bit different, right?
It's a little different. I was tripping. I was definitely nervous. And we ran through the jungle for like 4 hours, and the dogs got on a few pig scents, but we never got one.
Oh, okay.
So I have yet to kill a pig, but I actually just got a bow because in Santa Cruz they're a pig here, and it's something I'm interested in. It's
when I've looked at Shane Dorian stuff and listened to him, and it's makes me interested in it.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, if we're eating meat, that's it's the best meat that you can get. I mean, it's the most honest. And
I have no qualms about that.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to look at a few documentaries like Cowspiracy, I don't know if you've ever seen that.
No.
It's an eye-opening documentary to the meat industry.
Yeah.
And basically that, like, if we don't solve the meat crisis, we're fucked.
Yeah.
Because right now, one of the biggest environmental issues happening, I think, globally right now is the Amazon rainforest is being cut down for cattle grazing. Massive amounts of clear cutting, and it's probably the most dangerous place in the world to be an activist right now, because there are these tribes that live in the Amazon, and loggers will come in and destroy the rainforest, and they'll just fucking kill them. Like, if you stand up there, I mean, there was a story a few months ago of a nun down in Brazil getting killed, just getting offed, because there's that much money in it, and
yeah.
Brazil is now exporting their meat to the United States. Vice just did a story on it on their latest HBO season. I highly recommend checking it out. But it's one of those things that we really need to figure out. And I think that hunters are a perfect group to, A, like, you know, they're ones that are getting their own meat, and two, they are really fighting for open space more than most people. They're the ones that are putting the money out to have open space be available. When you get a hunting license, that money goes to restoration of the land.
Right.
It goes to keeping it open. There's a great story on Radiolab called The Rhino Hunter. I recommend anyone check it out. It's one of the best stories they've ever done. But it's all about this guy who's going to hunt an endangered black rhino in Namibia for $250,000. And it's kind of like the moral plight of, is it morally okay to hunt this endangered species if that money is going to go to land restoration and preservation of the species?
Interesting. Yeah, not an easy thing to answer.
Yeah.
They do a great job, too, with their podcast. Well, you covered a lot of my questions, actually, through some of what you've said. I want to chat about filmmaking real quickly. This feels like the era of documentary. I didn't know that your family had such a long history in it. But it really does, because there was always amazing documentaries when I was growing up in the previous decades. But I didn't feel like there was a adequate platform for them to be seen. You know, like, they weren't in the local movie theaters that I was going to. And then maybe I'd be able to find it at a video store, but often not. But now with Netflix, of course, it's like half of Netflix is populated by documentary. Obviously, you've utilized YouTube to great success. I wonder how much of it was just that it was the right medium to tell your stories versus did you look up to filmmakers growing up? Who were your influences as a filmmaker? What are your aspirations now moving forward? Do you have feature length things in mind? What?
Yeah. Big question.
Yeah.
Filmmaking
influences, maybe?
Yeah. I would say that, I was influenced a lot growing up by Vice, the media outlet. One of my good friends, Kaj Larson, who grew up on my same street, is a war correspondent for them. He has a number of segments on their latest HBO series. And, you know, I think that it was one of those things where it gave young filmmakers like myself permission to just go out with a camera and get in the shit and press the red button and see what we got, in a way that I kind of was just growing up in this time where, like, whoa, you could do that, and then you could record it to this platform called YouTube. Like, I had no real idea about the scale of how many people can see a video of yours if you go onto YouTube.
And, I mean, it's grown. You've helped grow it, to be honest, because it wasn't that many initially, and now it's insane.
Yeah. So I think that I have a lot of filmmaking influences.
Right.
Morgan Spurlock is one of them. He's the guy who did
Supersize Me,
and he's done Inside Man. It's a new CNN series. And he's selfie sticking while we're podcasting. Yeah. So many multimedia. Other filmmakers, Jaheen Newjim is one. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her name right, but she did one called Control Room, which was about the Iraq War. From Al Jazeera's perspective, while they were getting bombed in Iraq. She did one called The Square, which is about the Arab Spring in Egypt.
It was an Academy Award winner?
Nominated.
What are your aspirations for it?
Aspirations for myself?
For filmmaking. Do you plan to do...
Longer stuff?
Yeah, or expand beyond...
Well,
YouTube.
I mean, I've had a lot of fun just in the past year working on a few of these stories with Discovery because it's a level of support that I've never felt before. Like, I mean, you know, for a while it was kind of like just a couple of my friends and I just going around not really knowing what we were doing. Like my good friend Kyle Boothman, who got me into surfing, you know, was one of them. My buddy Andy, who's an editor down the street, and we would kind of just go out and be like, all right, well, we're going to see what we get and come back with it. And we, you know,
try to put it together.
Yeah, we'd mess up 100 times before kind of figuring out that there is a formula of like, all right, if you want to tell the story of world hunger, like do it through a family. It's like this idea of telling the macro through the micro, like show the universe on a blade of grass kind of idea. Where I started realizing like, oh, the more personal I can make it, the more universal. And that's the kind of stuff that I really like. I'm starting to get better. And it's kind of going to wrap around to your question of like my aspirations within filmmaking. It's like, I think that I'm starting to finally figure out what it is that I actually like to do. For a long time, I was saying like, oh, well, I like to filmmake and like, I like to surf. Like those are both true things, but they're so broad. Like, sometimes I like surfing. I like surfing, but sometimes I hate surfing. You know, like sometimes surfing is exercise. Sometimes surfing is an exercise in patience. Filmmaking, you know, sometimes I like editing, but really what I like doing is this. Like, I really enjoy having a conversation with you, an honest conversation, and just seeing where it goes and then coming back with that. So, I mean, my latest endeavor is that I'm starting a podcast. And just purely from that interest in just having conversations, because I think that one of the most powerful things that we can do in media is give honest testimonials, right? Just you or me giving my honest story, I think is more influential than all the bells and the whistles that come along with a lot of filmmaking.
Yeah.
So I definitely still enjoy the style of that kind of like verite, just get in the situation, ask some questions.
Yeah.
But I also am really enjoying the kind of support of like having a producer, having a writer to be like, oh yeah, great. Like we're, you know, here, we're going to help you along with this script, you know, having an editor. But then again, like I'm having to deal with some fears of like giving up some control for the time, right? Like with Surfing for Change, I had 100% control all the time. Like I could say whatever the fuck I wanted, and I had control in the edit room, and it was my piece. But it was only as good as I could make it, right? And I'm again blessed to be surrounded by a really talented group of friends in the Santa Cruz area who are filmmakers, but there is something to be said about getting into that bigger pool, which I feel like I finally jumped into. And even though I'm giving up some control, the pieces are getting better.
Yeah.
And then I now have this podcast that I'm coming out with where it's like, we were talking a little bit before where it's like, it's unedited. It is just raw conversations, which I also enjoy. And I think that over the next couple years, the goal would be come out with some kick-ass pieces. We have a few coming out that I shot this last year with Discovery. One is on the BP oil spill. We went out to Louisiana and did a story on that. And another was down in Chile that we shot a number of months ago on this indigenous conflict happening in southern Chile called the Mapuche. So the Mapuche are an indigenous tribe that live in southern Chile. And in the basically the late 1800s, they were colonialized and European settlers came in. A lot of their land was taken. And just now they're demanding their land back. What's happened as a result is, you know, the government of Chile has put a lot of anti-terrorist laws in place where they can detain Mapuche without charge. Really egregious human rights abuses happening down there. And these kind of third-generation European settlers who are now Chilean farmers are kind of caught in the middle of it because it's really big logging industry down there. Sure. So they took a lot of the land. The Mapuche want the land back. They're taking it back in some cases violently. There have been cases of them like burning down houses and logging trucks, then getting detained. And the Chilean families, you know, are now kind of caught in the middle of it. So we got to go down there. I actually got to go down with my girlfriend. She shot it. And we did a story on that that's now being edited up in San Francisco. But just like, dude, those kinds of stories of getting into a world where I get to be completely ignorant to the situation and be like, wow, I get to, it's my job to ask these stupid questions, is something that I just freaking love, man. So if I can combine surfing, being able to go out on these adventures that I love doing just for the sake of going and getting barreled or getting some fun waves, big waves with my friends, continuing to tell stories that I think are important and pushing my own filmmaking.
Yeah.
And with this new form of just kind of long form conversations, seeing where this experiment goes, I think that I'll be a happy camper.
Well, I'm a huge fan of filmmaking and documentary as well, and surf films specifically. Like, I grew up watching surf films and spent every extra $30 I had buying them, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Surf videos. And but I've lamented it as I've in the last decade, I guess, that the medium hasn't really changed that much and it hasn't really evolved, where I as a human and as a surfer have evolved into a more nuanced human being. And like, it's still just surf porn. The surfing's better. The cinematography's better. The technology of the cameras and stuff are better. So it's a more sophisticated degree of what – not even sophisticated. It's just a better degree of what it was before. But the formula hasn't really changed for a lot of the filmmakers. And so I've lamented that. But that's why I've enjoyed some of your stuff. And – there's been a couple others that I would name. Jason Baffa has done some interesting stuff. This film, I don't know that you saw it come out on Red Bull a couple weeks ago.
Let's Be Frank.
Did you see it?
Oh, my buddy Frank. It's so good.
So I interviewed him.
It's so good. Go see Let's Be Frank. I went down there for the premiere because Frank's a good friend of mine. And damn, they did a good job
on that one, right?
Yeah. It's just different. It shows that if you do something different, people are hungry for it. Yeah. I mean, what you're doing with this podcast, you're taking a new medium and you're just exploring it, right? Yeah. And people are digging it because it's not there before. Like, people don't want the silly sound bites. They want something that's real, or they want something that's just like authentic in some way.
Well,
right?
Well, so I interviewed Frank and the filmmaker, and I had him on the podcast, and was telling them the same thing that you're saying right now, is like, I don't need more surfing, dude. Like, what I need is story. Like, as I've become a more interesting human being as I've gotten older, like, I just want something of interest. I want some depth. And to be honest, I think it's just story. And so I think the success of a lot of the things that you've done is that you've tapped into stories and human interest and individuals. And sure, there's surfing tangentially related to these topics. But dude, if I want to watch A-plus surfing, like, I've got clips on Instagram right now that just happened yesterday at South Beach in Miami with Hurricane Matthew, and then last night at the Quick Pro France, because I didn't stay up for that. So, like, it's at my fingertips. I don't need you to go out and then produce something and months later show me, you know?
Right.
But what I do need you to do is what you're doing.
Right. I see that a lot, man. Like, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, too, because so surfing is this kind of unique sport, right, where it's you can become a pro surfer or be relevant in the surfing world without having to be one of the best surfers,
right?
Because it is such a lifestyle driven sport. I'm one of those guys, right? I mean, Nat surfs circles around me when we go out to the lane. I mean, it's no secret. But because it is such an interesting sport in the sense that we get to go to these places, we get to be involved in these stories that no one else has access to.
Yeah.
You can still make a pretty darn cool life for yourself. Totally. And it's sad for me to see like a lot of young pro surfers who aren't going to be the next John, but feel like they don't have anything to offer,
right?
Because their air versus are only 2 foot instead of 5 foot. But man, like, I mean, I think that one of the best podcasts out there is Tim Ferriss's podcast. Mm-hmm. And one thing that he focuses on and all of his guests talk about this is like, dude, focus on your strengths. Like, don't try and focus on what you're bad at and make that better. Understand what it is that you're good at and leverage that, right? And I find that most of the successful people that I've met, surrounded myself with, have figured that out. They're self-aware, and they know what it is that they're good at.
And know what their limitations are.
And they know what their limitations are. Yeah. Absolutely. Like, it's, what's the saying? Like, if a fish judges itself its entire life on its ability to climb a ladder, it'll think it's stupid.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's...
Well, I'm learning a lot about that at this phase of my life. Now I'm in my 30s, and it's like learning how to delegate to other people, learning that I'm not great at X, Y, and Z, but I'm really good at A, B, and C. So quit trying to fix X, Y, and Z. Delegate that out, dude. There's people. And the other thing, I feel like you're probably in the same boat where it's like, we have people around us who want us to succeed and they want to help us and they're like our supporters and champions. Rely on them. Allow them to help. Allow them to, you know, because, dude, we have all the resources in the world. Living in California, it's like, if you don't rely on those things, then...
Ask for help, man. Yeah. So, like, one of the greatest things that I stumbled upon when I was young, and I think that it really made the difference between, like, making that first video down in Chile and then being like, all right, now I'm going to go do something that I hate for the rest of my life and, like... actually making that decision to push forward and be like, no, this is something that I can kind of forge a career in, was my decision to ask people for help.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've done that so many times. Like, dude, I remember when I was doing a story in Hawaii, it was one of my very first ones, about plastic pollution. I saw Jack Johnson walking down the street and I freaking cornered him and was like, hey, will you please be in this movie? Like, it's about plastic pollution that, you know, I'm an 18-year-old kid and I didn't really know what I was doing. And he was like, absolutely, sure. Like, I'd love to help you. I mean, same with like Annie Leonard. She's this really high profile environmental activist. She made the Story of Stuff series, which is great. You can check it out on YouTube. She's now the executive director of Greenpeace. Like, she has helped me so much with contacts, with, just learning how to navigate the field, learning what landmines are out there and how not to step on them. And, right. And ultimately, man, it's like, it is makes you feel really good when you can help someone out.
Yeah, totally. People, and that's the thing. They want to help.
They want to help.
You know?
Yeah. So that's, I mean,
interesting. Well, along your point of like, know what your strengths are. Some of the most successful people we know and people that Tim Ferriss has interviewed and stuff, these kind of world changers and industry leaders and peak performers, even like Steve Jobs, the guy was just an orchestrator, you know, like he brought on programmers and surrounded himself, but he knew his skill set was conductor.
Yeah.
And now I need a violinist and I need a whatever. And then I'm going to implement those people, which those roles are actually more important than the conductor role, but you know,
yeah. And I think that what happens a lot of times too is people overload themselves with work and then they become so busy that they can't do any one thing really well.
Right.
There's a good book that I just read by a guy named Tim Kreider called We Learn Nothing. And he just kind of has this dark humor when he talks about his view of the world. And he has this whole chapter called Busy, or it's called Lazy, A Manifesto. And it's all about how when you ask someone how they're doing now, they say busy. Like, how you doing? Like, oh, busy. I'm like, crazy busy. So busy. And it's like, well, why? What is it that you... I think that partly it's this, like, self-important thing. Like, oh, my God, I'm so busy. Like, I have no time for anything. But, man, I know some of the most productive people I've ever met, and they don't say they're busy because they're so good at delegating to other people that they're able to focus on what it is that they're really good at and be financially successful, mentally successful, spiritually successful, physically successful. And the people who don't, fucking drown, man.
And people confuse or trick themselves into thinking that busy means productive.
Right.
And it totally isn't.
Right.
Let's get back on track a little bit here. I want to talk about fitness just a little bit, especially being a professional surfer and surfing big waves. It seems like professional surfers and especially big wave surfers have a much more committed but also comprehensive approach to health and well-being nowadays, where it's not just focus on diet and exercise. You're also focused on recovery, focused on mental wellness, focused on life balance, you know? What does your, and meditation or whatever, what does your fitness program look like?
Changes all the time, but I've definitely learned a lot about myself and learned a lot about how far I can and cannot go. I tend to jump into things head first and go into the deep end. So when I was like, I want to start surfing Mavericks, I'm like, I'm going to order 4 big wave boards and be out there every day that I can and, you know, train like crazy. And I see that a lot with a lot of young big wave surfers, and it kind of creates this burnout effect where you'll see someone get super psyched on it for a little while and then burn out. And I've really had to kind of tone back and be like, well, what is it that actually keeps my love of the ocean alive? I think that everything that I'm doing, like, ultimately it's about keeping myself in the water.
Yeah.
And if you are in the water a lot, you're going to be in good shape. You're going to be in rhythm with the waves. Like, we all know what it feels like to not surf for a few weeks and get back on your board and you feel like a kook. Like, just keeping in that rhythm. And surfing is one of those sports where it's always hard. Like, skating, I cannot skate. I can take, like, 3 months off of skating, get back on a ramp, and I feel like I'm right back where I was because it's the same ramp.
Yeah.
But surfing, if I don't surf for, like, a week and a half, I'm like, dude, I forgot how to do this. And it takes me 3 sessions to feel like I'm getting back to surfing okay. So a lot of what I've been doing lately has been figuring out ways to stay in the water every single day, whether that's going on an ocean swim, whether it's body surfing and hand planing. We have some cool little beach breaks around here that I have some fun at. Longboarding.
It's all right.
It's all right. But just anything to keep my, like, stoke for the ocean alive has been a big part of my training, if that's what you want to call it. I live with Tyler Fox, who's really kind of fitness junkie, for lack of a better word. But we do a lot of stairs. There's a place just down the street where there's a big staircase, stairs and jump rope, and just keeping that kind of cardio alive. Spearfishing whenever I can. I'm really enjoying that because it's the perfect additive sport to surfing. It's like, oh my God, it's dead flat. Great day to go to go spearfishing. So staying in the water as much as possible. And I just got a membership at the rock climbing gym. I don't know if that's going to help big wave surfing at all, but it's been really fun. Like, I think that there is also this element of, like, putting yourself in situations where you're scaring yourself a lot that is really good for training to surf big waves. Because it's something that we lack, right? Yeah. Like, going to work, being on the computer, checking emails, like, you don't have to have that focus on, like, all right, I got to focus on my breath and really kind of have that self-talk going.
Yeah.
And, dude, like, I go down to Pacific Edge, which is the local rock climbing gym, scare the shit out of myself, even though I know that if I fall, I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
Just that feeling of having to hone my breath in has been really fun. So I do that, and I try and sweat a lot. I listen to a good podcast, with Dr. Rhonda Patrick. She's just this fantastic doctor, wellness coach, and she was on Joe Rogan talking about how there was this long-term study. Squirrels are everywhere.
These guys are having a blast.
Squirrels trying to have
fun. They're climbing through your wetsuits.
Squirrels trying to have fun in the backyard. Rats with fluffy tails. So Dr. Rhonda Patrick was doing a podcast on how it was a long-term study based on that if you got in a sauna 3 times a week, you're likely to live X amount of years longer.
Fascinating.
Because what heat and cold exposure do is they activate your FOXO3 cells, I believe they're called, which are kind of your anti-aging cells. So if you ever see someone who's like 100 years old and they've been smoking their whole lives, like chances are it's because they have overactive FOXO3 cells. So I've been going down the street and I've been doing hot yoga and hot Pilates because I can barely touch my toes and I'm super tight.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of things, man. And seriously, it's about staying in the water. And for me, it's about having fun and just keeping that zest alive and sweating a lot and doing things that are new.
Have you explored cold water therapy?
Yeah.
Or no, just cold therapy?
Well, every morning I run down the street and I jump in the ocean.
With trunks on?
With trunks, yeah.
No way.
Yeah, so that's been fun. Well, Wim Hof inspiration there. Right. I don't go in super long. I'll usually just run down the street, jump in the water, force my girlfriend to come with me. It's always a good little way to start a fight in the morning. But come on, babe, let's do it. No.
Good news is it's hard to be mad after that. Like,
right.
It shocks your system so much that all the anger is gone.
Well, I've never seen something that so consistently puts you in a better mood
does,
and makes
dude,
you feel like you're in a good place, and so consistently you resist it. You're like, I know right. This is really good for me, but I really don't want to do this right now.
It's a challenge every single time.
Yeah,
dude.
But I mean, this morning before this podcast, ran down the street, got in the ocean, caught 3 waves on my longboard. Came
in trunks?
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. Get into some wrap up questions real quick, since we're running out of time. What does your current travel schedule look like? What's next on the docket?
I'm here for the next little while. Cool. I've been in this place where I've been running around doing all these stories and gathering a bunch of podcast interviews. So I have them all banked, and a lot of the stories are being edited right now, the documentaries, and I'm kind of getting in a place to launch the podcast. And it's really hard to do a lot of that on the road, so it's been fantastic being at home and just kind of getting into a little rhythm of productivity and training and surfing and spearfishing. So I'm going to be around the Santa Cruz area for a little while, which I'm so happy to say.
Good time of year, too, right?
Good time of year. We got a good swell coming. I try and save my traveling for spring and summer.
Yeah.
And then I'm home for winter.
Cool.
Yeah.
You talk about, or you've talked about, I don't even remember where I saw it, but you've talked about the key to happiness is being in service, you know? What are you in service of right now?
It's a good question. I think that more than anyone, I mean, I have a number of issues that I'm passionate about bringing to light. But I think that I've been asking myself this question a lot. And I think that right now, the thing that I'm most excited about, and I think that the thing that I can offer people most is tools for them to not be victims to themselves. And whether that is a tool of a morning routine that can really help. I think that these little changes that we make in our daily lives can lead to bigger changes, which can lead to ultimately the kind of social and political change that I'm passionate about. And secondly, just bringing stories forward that people find interesting. You know, I mean, I cannot tell you, and a lot of the service that I feel like I can provide is what I get most. And over the past year, after I was doing a bit of reflecting, I'm like, man, it's podcasts. Like I listen to so many podcasts and they've fundamentally changed my life with testimonials from people who have gone through these life experiences. They've gone through rough times. They've developed tools to get through them. So if I can bring people on who I have access to and have these conversations, that's something that I find could be really helpful because they've helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And figuring out how to ask really good questions.
Yeah.
Asking better questions, I think is something that can change the world.
That'll serve you well as a podcast host for sure.
Yeah.
The final question that I ask everybody, who's interviewed is just, what was the last board that you rode?
Last board that I rode was this morning. I rode a, where is it? Some big 10-foot single fin, that could probably take someone's head off if placed in the wrong zone. And I rode it this morning on some little 1-foot waves.
Who shaped it?
Who did shape that? You know, like, so we have a bunch of surfers in this house, and we kind of just have this revolving door of boards, and I have no idea who shaped the board or who it belongs to, but it's kind of one of those things where, like, if it's in our backyard, we have license to use it. So I think someone just dropped it off here and never remembered.
We're sitting in the backyard overlooking the quiver right now. I'll take a photo of it and post it on Instagram at Surf Splendor, of course. Who do you normally get boards from?
I get some boards from Fletcher Chouinard. That's the Patagonia boards, which have been working really good. They're really strong, and I got a couple good shortboard models under my feet right now. And I've been getting my big boards from Travis Reynolds.
Yeah.
He shapes a lot of Tyler Fox's boards, and man, they work good.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen he's done really well in the last few years.
And I've gotten a couple boards recently from a guy named Kalu Coletta, Steve Coletta's son, and he shaped some smooth boards, man. He shaped me some boards that I took down to Puerto Escondido with me this summer, and they worked great.
Cool. Yeah, I saw him a day or two ago.
Yeah.
All right, man. Right on. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it. And anyone out there listening, feel free to get in touch with me. I love... love connecting. And
what's the best way for people to get a hold of you?
You know, I actually just started a new website called kyle.surf.
I saw that.
And from there you can reach me on all the usual socials.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah, thanks for the good questions.
No compromise.
We have a link to kyle.surf and Kyle's Instagram and YouTube page all on surfsplendorpodcast.com. You can also make sure to see the selfies that we snapped during this interview and a little bit of video as well, actually, that I recorded during this interview on our social media pages at Surf Splendor on Instagram and then facebook.com/Surf Splendor. Of course, remember to go to surfsplendorpodcast.com and drop a little change in the donation bucket. Be among the first. We've had so many people in recent years say, you know what, if you guys ever donate, I will be the first to donate. Well, there can only be one. Let it be you. Actually, probably already taken place, but you could still donate. We'll still accept it. Like I said, click that monthly recurring thing to make sure to, you know, be consistent with it. Keep the show flowing. So thank you for that. That's all the panhandling I will do for this episode. Rest assured, I'll do it again next episode. At any rate, thank you for persevering that. And then also thank you to Kyle Tierman for participating in this episode. What a gracious young man, and really hosted me actually at his home and gave me all the time that I needed. So I really appreciate that. Feel like the episode benefited from it. And Kyle actually has a podcast that he will be introducing shortly. Hasn't gone live yet, but he has recorded a number of episodes. And so I will make sure to keep you posted on when that gets released, or just follow him on social and you'll find, I'm sure he'll talk about it once it's ready to go. That's all the rambling that I have for this week of Surf Splendor. This is David Scales, your host of Surf Splendor, reminding you just above and beyond anything else, get back in the ocean, get a couple waves, and as always, shred on.